Isaiah 53 is where we are now. By the way, chapters 1 through 39, the main theme of those chapters was what? Judgment. And even though other themes were in those chapters, the main focus of chapters 1 through 39 was judgment and who is being judged. What the announcement is that who is going to be judged. Definitely Israel. The first thing that pops into my mind is the nations, all of the surrounding nations. So you have, let me just lump them all together, the nations, and that includes, of course, Assyria and Babylon, two of the biggies, and all the other nations, Ethiopia, Egypt, all the others that are mentioned. And so all those nations are going to be judged, and it's also striking that in chapters 1 through 39, who else is going to be judged? Jerusalem, yes, the city of Jerusalem, and Israel, they are called Ephraim, and Judah. Judah and Jerusalem is the city in Judah. But Israel and Judah also are going down, you see. And so that's the theme of chapters 1 through 39. It's sort of surprising when you get to these chapters that tell us that Israel and Judah are going to be judged. We thought that they were a little special and maybe would avoid the judgment, but no, judgment is going to come on all of these. But then when we get to chapters 40 through 66, the theme is more focused on what? Well, that redemption, yeah, redemption. So those are the two big themes in Isaiah, judgment and redemption. And chapter, the break comes between 39 and 40, where we're now focusing on redemption. And what we're doing here in chapter 53 now is Isaiah is unveiling the Redeemer. You know, if you got redemption, there must be a Redeemer, right? And so Isaiah now is going to tell us about this Redeemer. So that's, we sort of started this last week, you might remember. Last time we saw the unveiling, the initial unveiling of this great Redeemer. It says in chapter 52 and verse 13, "Behold my servant." And so Isaiah pulled the covering off of this great work of art. And the people were astonished in verse 14. Do you see that? "As many as were astonished at thee." Now, they weren't astonished in a good way. Do you remember? They didn't open their mouth and say, "Oh, what a beautiful Redeemer we have." But they were sort of astonished in a bad way. They were astonished, actually, at his great deformity. His visage was marred, do you remember? And revulsion might be a good word to describe how they viewed this Redeemer. They had a very strong feeling of distaste and disgust. Now, we're talking generally about the people of Israel, the Jews. And this is how they reacted to the unveiling of the Redeemer. They didn't expect their Redeemer would be so disfigured. He was marred beyond recognition. His face was ripped to shreds so that he was not even recognizable as a man. It's not that they couldn't recognize who he was, but they couldn't even recognize that he was a man after his flesh was ripped off his body, basically, during the scourging. So it says in Isaiah 52:14, "His visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men." Now, this was not the kind of a Redeemer that Israel expected, and it was not the kind of a Redeemer that they would accept. Now, They wanted someone probably more like Moses, strong-looking man. At least he resembled a man, you see. And perhaps they would have even accepted someone like Cyrus, who wasn't even a Jewish person, but he redeemed them out of Babylon. They probably would have accepted someone like that. But not this man. This man can't possibly be the promised Redeemer. Let me get this thing figured out here. Of course, this speaks volumes about the nation of Israel, doesn't it? They were not too concerned about the redemption from their sins. They were not too aware of their need for a Redeemer who would suffer and pay the penalty for their sins, but they were looking for a strong man to redeem them from the bondage of Rome, and so they turned away in disgust from this Redeemer who Isaiah unveiled. Now, this is exactly how the Jews treated Jesus when he finally came 700 years later. You remember reading the New Testament, and that's exactly how they treated him. It says in John 1:11, he came unto his own, and who is his own? That's the Jews. And his own received him not. That's the general principle. That's for the most part what happened. Not only did they not receive him, but they affirmatively rejected him. They turned away from him in utter contempt. This was not the kind of Redeemer that they wanted, and so they reviled him and they spat upon him and they turned him over for crucifixion. But the rejection of the Redeemer by the Jews did not prevent the Redeemer from redeeming a people. That's the amazing thing, you see. It didn't stop him. This Redeemer, the book of Isaiah teaches us, would take his redemptive work to another people. And look at 52:15. This is what we took a look at last time, 52:15. So shall he sprinkle many what? Nations. So you see, they were astonished in a bad way. They wouldn't accept him, but he's going to sprinkle many nations. So he's going to reach out to the nations of the world and gather a people. So we see here one of the great themes of Isaiah, that is the calling out of a people from among the Gentiles. Now, we've seen this theme appear throughout the book of Isaiah. Let me just remind you of a couple of places. Turn to Isaiah 11. Isaiah 11 and verse 10. As early as that, we were seeing that this Redeemer would reach out to the Gentiles. It says, and in that day there shall be a root of Jesse. Who's the root of Jesse, by the way? That's Christ, of course. Which shall stand for an ensign of the people, to it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. So even in chapter 11 we were seeing it. Take a look at Isaiah 42. Isaiah 42:6. And Isaiah 42:6 says, I, the Lord, have called thee in righteousness, talking of Jesus, and will hold thine hand and will keep thee and give thee for a covenant of the people, for a light of the Gentiles. 49:6, which we covered not long ago, says, and he said, it is a light thing that thou shouldst be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the who? Gentiles, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth. So this is not a new theme here. He is going to go to the nations. By the way, there are two groups that he's really going to redeem, and who is that? We saw it in that last verse there in chapter 49, verse 6. Two groups. What's the first group? The remnant of Israel. So there's going to be a small portion of Israel that he's going to redeem. Here's Israel, the big circle, but a few of them, he's going to redeem them, and then the second group are the Gentiles. So this is who redemption in the spiritual sense really applies to. So now we're seeing it again that the Gentiles are far more willing to receive the gospel of a suffering Savior than are the Jews. But now tonight, let's consider why it is that the Redeemer was so unappealing. Why was this Redeemer such an unappealing Redeemer, you see? Why is it that the Jews especially would not have such a Redeemer? And first of all, we're going to see that he is an unappealing Redeemer because of his humble origin. They didn't expect that. I suspect they thought maybe he'd be born in Jerusalem. Born somewhere besides in a stable somewhere. Born with the cattle mooing. I don't know what other animals they had. Chickens run around or whatever. You know, a stable, a place where animals. And so we have the metaphor here, by the way, in verse 2, of the tender branch. Do you see that? In verse 2, it says, chapter 53 and verse 2, "For he shall grow up before him as a tender branch." Now, you would have expected, maybe, that the Redeemer of the world would burst onto the scene with great pomp and circumstance. You would expect him to be a mighty oak tree. But instead, he is pictured by Isaiah here as being a little tender plant. He's a little sprig extending from the root of the tree. Now, I have a crepe myrtle several crepe myrtles, actually, but one of them by my driveway at home. And each fall, I have to trim off all the lower branches. These sprigs sprout out during the spring and summer, and they're too low. They get in the way, and so I cut them all off. But in the spring, amazingly, little shoots start shooting out again. And they come out of the trunk of the tree. And they're very tender and weak. You can come up with your fingers and just break them off. And this is the way Jesus came on the scene. He was born in a stable. He was the son of poor, insignificant parents. He lived on the poor side of town, which was Nazareth. And he was just a little sprig of a plant. Perhaps he was the unwanted sprig that would be pinched off in the spring. And there was nothing special about him. So you see his very humble origins, and he's pictured as a little tender plant. He's also pictured by another metaphor in verse 2. And what's that metaphor? A root coming out of dry ground. Now, when I was younger, we lived in California, we'd visit my grandmother in the desert. And we'd go to the desert, and of course, you know, no water there in the desert, and the ground is just dry as a bone. You know, nothing could grow except cactus, I guess. I remember being a lot of cactus and yucca trees. But the metaphor here is that he was like a root out of dry ground. Jesus was like a little root or a sprig coming up out of dry ground. You wouldn't even expect it to live. The circumstances of his existence did not favor him being a great deliverer. No one would have looked at him and said, "This man is going to be the Redeemer of the world." He's just a little sprig coming out of dry ground. So his very survival was in doubt. So Isaiah uses those two metaphors to describe his humble origins. But take a look at verse 2. And let's take a look at those who witnessed his origins. It says in verse 2, "For he shall grow up." Now, who is it talking about when it says, "For he shall grow up"? That's Christ. Now, here's where the problem comes in. "He shall grow up before him." Now, so I ask the question, who does the him refer to? And that's a very good answer. And I would probably say most commentators suggest that the hymn refers to God, and I wouldn't argue with that. Of course, that is certainly true. Jesus was always under the purview of God, under the protection of God. He was a little tender plant that might get stepped on or plucked up at any moment, you see. And God certainly watched over him. So he was always under the protection of God, even though he was a tender shoot. God would make sure that he would not be broken off, and so Jesus would always be in the watchful sight of God. That's one interpretation. But let me just suggest this to you for your consideration. This context seems to suggest that someone else is watching him grow up. Let me just show you what I'm talking about. Look at verse 2. For he shall grow up before him, we're trying to determine who this him is, as a tender plant and as a root out of a dry ground, he hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him. You see? There is no beauty that we should desire him. Also, look in verse 3. Verse 3, it says, and we did hide, as it were, our faces from him. And in verse 4, yet we did esteem him stricken. So somebody is watching these humble origins of Jesus, you see. And it appears that the hymn of verse 2 may refer to the nation of Israel, those neighbors, those Israeli neighbors, the countrymen who were there and saw Jesus. And that certainly would be true as well. The nation of Israel watched this little shoot grow up, and they had a very specific reaction to him, didn't they? It says they turned their faces from him, and they esteemed him stricken of God. They thought God was punishing him. Their perception of Jesus was that he was a criminal and that he died for his own criminal acts. So I think that's also a possible interpretation of who the him is in verse 2, and it makes sense to me in the context. Israel referred to as a him there. Either way is a good interpretation because both are true. But also, let's take note of his general appearance in the world. What did he look like? It says in verse 2, he hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. I think when you read that, most of us, at least, would see this as a very brief description of the physical appearance of Jesus. It seems at least to be a reference to what he perhaps looked like in his physical form. What does it say about his form there, by the way? He had no form. Now, obviously, all physical things have form, right? All human beings have form. So when it says that he has no form, what this means is that he had no particularly desirable form to him. That's what this passage is about. He had no desirable form to him. If you saw him, you would not immediately say, this man will surely be our king. This man is going to be our deliverer. There was nothing about his form that would have assured you of that. Also, it says, nextly, that he had no comeliness. You see that? He had no comeliness. Now, we don't use that word comeliness much anymore, but comeliness is the opposite of what? Homeliness. That's the word I came up with anyway, as an opposite. If you are homely looking, you're rather unattractive. But if you are comely, you are rather pleasing in your appearance. And Jesus had no comeliness. People didn't look at Jesus and say, this man will surely be our deliverer. His physical appearance, apparently, did not cause the Jews to desire him. Now, this probably should encourage us to be careful about making judgments based on outward appearance. You know, this world has lots of people in it, and not everyone's like us in every way, and people are quite different. Some people are short, some people are skinny, some people are not made to exact proportions, some people are not muscular, if you're a man. And so we need to be careful about making judgments about human beings on outward appearances, don't we? Because there's an inner person to all of us. And we're all probably prone to do that. We make judgments about the way a person looks. But that's not the way God makes judgments. It says in 1 Samuel 16:7, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the what? On the heart. That's really what's important about a man, is his heart. And that's what was important about Jesus. If you looked on the outward part of him, you never would have dreamed that this man was the deliverer, but God looks on the heart. You see, there was a heart of gold in there. Let's move on here and talk about his general condition in this world. We see that in verses 3 and 4. It says, he is what? Despised and rejected of men. Now, this is not primarily trying to teach us about the Jews, but it's trying to teach us about Jesus. This is one of his characteristics. He lived in a state of rejection. And so his life was characterized by rejection. This word despised, by the way, in our language, when we use the word despised, we are talking most often about a passionate hatred. You despise a person, you feel something deep inside, a hatred passionately about that person. But that's not the sense in the original language. The idea in the original language is that they did not accept him with regard to his intended purpose. They pushed him away. He was the deliverer, and yet they said, you're not my deliverer. Let me give you an example. Does anybody remember what Esau despised? His birthright. Esau despised his birthright. Now, he really didn't hate his birthright. He would have liked to have had it, but he gave it up for something else, right? So the idea of despising his birthright didn't mean that he hated his birthright, but it meant that he turned his back on it. And that's the sense here. Jesus came with this glorious purpose of redemption, and his people turned their backs on that purpose. They wouldn't have him as a redeemer. And so you see that Jesus walked around in the world as the despised one, that is, the rejected one. Let me give you an example. Certain men are just born into this world to be great at something. A few people in this world, where it just seems they were born to be something. Babe Ruth was born to play what? Baseball, obviously. But can you imagine if they had told Babe Ruth when he came to the ballpark, sorry, we're not going to allow you to play baseball. We reject you as a baseball player. Babe Ruth would have lived his whole life without realizing his potential. What if Galileo had not been allowed to study the stars? Why, he would have felt despised or rejected. What if General Patton had been rejected from the army? By the way, I noticed that after Donald Trump was elected president, that some took to the streets with signs that said, not our president, you see. We reject you as our president. and they refused to give him his due. He was duly elected and yet rejected by some. And of course, Jesus was duly elected by God to be the Redeemer. Now, he didn't look like it, at least in our estimation of things. But men turned their back on him and would not recognize him as the thing that he was born to do. He walked around with the sense that he was rejected of men. He lived his whole life like that. The very people that should have embraced him rejected him in that sense. Secondly, so his life was characterized first by rejection, but his life was also characterized by sorrows. Do you see that? By sorrows. This seems to be the general condition of his soul while he was on the earth. If you had to describe what was going on inside of Jesus for 30-something years while he walked the earth, he was a man of sorrows. His business was a very serious business, and of course his business was to ultimately culminate in great torture and death. Now, let me ask you, how would you like to live your life knowing that rejection and crucifixion was your destiny? A tough way to live. And so Isaiah says he was a man of sorrows. By the way, there are a couple of occasions in the Bible that where we're told that Jesus wept. Do you remember what those two occasions are? Pardon? When Lazarus died, Jesus wept. And when is the other time that I recall, anyway, when he wept? Looking over the city of Jerusalem, he saw their hopeless condition, and he wept. And that was an expression of the fact that he was a man of sorrows. He was a man of sorrows with respect to his own condition, and also with respect to the condition of others. When he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, it says that he was in great agony, and he sweated what? Great drops of blood. I remember reading years ago about that. Doctors tell us that when a person is under extreme stress, sometimes blood vessels may burst under the skin. It's very rare. And the blood will seep through the pores of the skin. And Jesus sweated great drops of blood when he was agonizing in the garden. But this sorrow seems to be a generalized condition that hung over him during the course of his life. He had a very somber mission when you think about it, and sorrow was embedded deep in his soul. He was also characterized by pain. Now, our version says grief. Do you see that? He says he's a man of sorrows and acquainted with what? Grief. That word literally means pains. He was acquainted with pain. Now, we don't know exactly what pains Isaiah was talking about, do we? We don't know exactly what pain Jesus had. I suspect that Isaiah has reference to soulish kind of pains here. Grief of spirit. Some people have suggested that Jesus may have been burdened down with physical sicknesses. But we just don't know. We have no other evidence in the Bible that Jesus was a physically sick person. I would suspect that he was probably subject to sicknesses just like anyone else. Jesus had a real human body. Sometimes we think of Jesus as not having a real human body, but he had a very real human body just like ours, subject to weaknesses, not sin, but subject to the frailty of human flesh. And his human body suffered pains. You might remember that when he traveled to Samaria to meet the woman at the well, where did he sit down? Where did he sit down when he arrived? Sat down on the well, And it says that he was tired and weary. It says that he sat down thus on the whale. That is, in a wearied and hungry condition. So he sat down on the whale. He probably slumped over. He was sweating. He probably got a runny nose in the winter, just like we do. But when it says that he was acquainted with grief or pains, this is probably not a specific reference to any particular sickness. We don't have any evidence of that. And probably was not a reference primarily to physical sickness, but it was a general characteristic of his life. He hurt. He was not immune to pains. He was well acquainted with both physical pain and soulish pain. Just to once again cover point number one, because it comes up again. In verse 3, his life again was characterized by personal rejection. It says, he is despised and rejected of men. How would you like to go through life with the perception that no one accepted you? Some people feel like that. Some people feel like that. And Jesus felt like that. He was a rejected person. Everyone looks on you as a poor misfit. And of course, you know that there are some good qualities in you, but others don't see it. That's a difficult situation to be in. Jesus knew that he was the greatest human being that ever lived, and yet that they did not esteem him as such. And so he lived with this sense of personal rejection. But I want you to see also in this passage his substitutionary purpose in this world. You see, Jesus wasn't here for his own gratification or his own purposes, but he was here to substitute for others. Take a look at verses 4 through 6, and we're going to see the substitutionary purpose of Christ. It says, surely he hath borne what? Our griefs. Now, you're going to see in the next three verses here this contrast between him and us. He hath borne our griefs. He carried our sorrows. You see, he was a man of sorrows, but it was really our sorrows that he was carrying. I'll try to explain that in a minute. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted, but he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. Are you seeing substitution here? The chastisement of our peace, that probably means the chastisement which led to our peace, was upon him. With his stripes, we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. So I want you to see his great sorrow here. We see the great grief which he bore in his life. But what we must see, what you must see, and what I must see tonight is that he bore these things for us. He was a man of rejection and a man of sorrows and a man of grief for me. We see his emotional pain and his physical pain, and yet all of this pain was really pain laid on him from me. My pain laid on him. Let me just suggest to you that there was no reason other than me for Jesus to suffer on his own account. He didn't deserve it. Suffering was not required on his part. He wasn't a child of Adam. He inherited no sin. His ledger sheet was clean from the very beginning. He never sinned himself. And furthermore, he never sinned personally, and so he was accepted by God on his own merits. So why all the suffering? Why is he a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief? And the answer is that he is bearing our sorrows. This is what we must understand about Jesus. He was our substitute. Jesus is not just a good example. He's not just a nice story, a way to live. He is a good example. But he's much more than that. He actually took our place. He stood in our shoes and suffered. Now, we wouldn't have been that impressed if Jesus had been born to rich parents, if Jesus had lived in a royal palace, if Jesus had all the nice things in life, if he had been shielded from pain and grief. We wouldn't have been too impressed with that. But Jesus was born to poor parents and lived in very humble circumstances and had none of the nice things in life. And pain and grief were part and parcel of his life. And now, after reading Isaiah, we understand that he did it in order to suffer in our place. All of the suffering that he endured from birth till death, he suffered in our place. We have a suffering Redeemer who took our pains upon himself. He took our sorrows upon himself. Jesus suffered pain on our account. And I would have to say that he is a great substitute. And part of that substitution is suffering our pain and paying our penalty for sin. You know from reading the scriptures that sin brings pain. Sin brings sorrows and pains and grief. Sin brings emotional distress. Sin brings sorrow. Sin ultimately brings death. And Jesus said, I will pay these things. Let me suffer pain. Let me suffer sorrow. Let me suffer death. And he came to suffer these things as our substitute. Now, those of us who have trusted Jesus and who have embraced him as our substitute will never suffer the retribution of God. I want you to think about that. We will never, ever suffer the retribution of God. That means a payback for sin. That means his wrath over sin. You and I will never, ever suffer what Jesus suffered. God's wrath on account of sin will never be poured out on you and me. But it was poured out on him. You and I will never know by experience what he suffered on our account. We'll just never know it. And I don't want to ever know it. I don't ever want to know that kind of ultimate pain. But let me ask you, do we suffer a few pains waiting on our ultimate redemption? Yeah. We suffer a little bit. Do we feel the nudge of the rod of God's discipline ever so often? I do. I'm sure you probably do. But we never, ever feel the heat of his retribution for sin. All of that was laid on our substitute. We should see the doctrine of imputation in this passage. Let me write it on the board here. As I usually do, I use the ledger sheet example. Let's call this Jesus here. And this is me. And what was on Jesus' debit side? He had no debits. No inherited sin from Adam because he wasn't born of a human father. So he didn't inherit Adam's sin, and he had no personal sins logged on his debit side. So he had a perfect debit side. What about his asset side? What did he have over there? Pardon? It was perfect righteousness. Let's put a capital R there, you see. Perfect righteousness. That's the way he was in his life. What about me? Well, I had Adam's sin, and I had my own sins, right? That's my debit side. Doesn't look too good. That's not going to get me into heaven. More importantly, that's not going to make me accepted before God. Heaven's just the benefit. But real salvation is being accepted by God. I had a bad debit side, and what did I have on my asset side? Nothing. No righteousness to offer. When I knock on heaven's gates, I have nothing to offer on that side of the ledger sheet. But you're going to notice in our passage here that something was imputed to Christ's debit side. And what was it? Transgressions and iniquities, our text says. Let's read it. It says, he was wounded, verse 5, for what? Our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquity. So what happened is God took my iniquities and posted them on his account. That's called imputation, you see. It wasn't that Jesus was himself personally that way, but my sins found their way over to his account. So our iniquities and our transgressions were imputed to him, and therefore he bore the penalty. So what does it say about that? Well, he bore our griefs and our sorrows. He suffered wounds in verse 5, which you read about in the Gospels. He suffered bruises, verse 5. He suffered chastisement. And he suffered stripes in verse 5. Do you see all of that? All of that he suffered because your and my sins were transferred to his account. But the beautiful part of this for us is that he transfers something to us. And what does he transfer to us? His righteousness. So he transfers his righteousness over to my account. The imputation of righteousness, that is justification. It makes me justified before God. So his righteousness was imputed to us. Look at verse 5. It says, the chastisement of our peace, that is worded strangely, so that it's hard to understand, but it means the chastisement which led to our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are what? Healed. The idea is that he took upon himself our sins and our penalties, and we took to ourselves what rightfully belonged to him, and that was peace and health. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are what? Healed. So our sins were transferred to his account, and his righteousness was transferred to our account. Paul quoted David in the book of Romans, and he described it this way. Even as David also describes the blessedness of the man unto whom God imputeth what? Righteousness without works, saying, blessed are they whose iniquities are forgiven and whose sins are covered.